WTBI 88.9 FM in Irvine, broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And today my guest is the esteemed author Alex Kate Shulman, author of 11 books, including the best-selling classic of the 70s, Memoirs of an Ex-Prom Queen. Her stories and essays have appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, Ms., The Woman's Review of Books, and The New York Times. She divides her time between New York City and Maine. Her current book, A Good Enough Daughter, was published late last year by Shocken Books. Are you there, Alex?
Yes, I'm here, Barbara.
Thank you so much for being on the show. It's an honor to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Tell me, how is it that you write such timely books? In the 70s, Memoirs of an Ex-Prom Queen spoke to so many women, and now, almost 30 years later, A Good Enough Daughter speaks to women again. Will you talk about how these two books relate?
Sure. I'm glad you think that what I write is timely, because that's never exactly my intention. I just write what's very much on my mind or causing me puzzlement or conflict, and it turns out that's what many, many others of my generation, and maybe even some other generations, are also thinking about. When I published Memoirs of an Ex-Prom Queen in 1972, I very much was writing a novel. It was fiction. And my new book, A Good Enough Daughter, is very much not fiction. It is a memoir, and everything that happens in it is more or less true, more or less because it's as true as I know it. when I wrote Prom Queen, it was an era of great social upheaval, and I was much more interested in social forces. It's really a social novel than in family life or family influences.
Mm-hmm.
But now, 30 years later, with the experience of 30 years, I realize that family is much more important than I ever thought it was back then. And I am trying in my new memoir to really settle a lot of unfinished business. Maybe I shouldn't even put it that way. I wasn't trying to settle it. Unfinished business was getting settled before my eyes. This is the story of my life as a daughter, really, of parents who died at the ages of 89 and 95 a few years ago, 7 months to the day apart. And I had lived a life very much apart from them. I was raised in Cleveland, Ohio, in the suburb Cleveland Heights. And when I got to be 20, I took off for New York, and I really seldom looked back. Of course, I never was estranged from my parents. They were very loving and understanding, and I always had great affection for them, but I was living a life that I didn't think they would very much approve of. I was in the middle of the political activities of the 60s. I became a feminist. I was arrested for protest marches, you know. And my father was a very upstanding lawyer and rather puritanical. When I started writing, I was writing about sex, and I just couldn't have done it if I had stayed with them, close to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a pretty common story. People nowadays in this country are so mobile, and so many people move away from their parents when they get out of high school or college. It's a very common thing, and then especially people who go to the coasts, you know,
mm-hmm.
and have a very different life from the one that they grew up with, or that they grew up expecting to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so, though we were never estranged, we didn't stay in real close contact, you know, the duty visits, the birthday calls, the holiday calls, but that was about it. And then, at the end of their lives, I was the only living child of their marriage, and it fell to me to begin to pay attention to them and take care of them in their old age.
Yes.
I had expected it to be a burden, like so many people of our generation. I think people expect that, you know. you have to stop your life and start treating your parents in ways that you never thought you would do, you know, take care of them. But instead of being a burden, for me, it turned out to be a very fulfilling experience. One of the great adventures of my life, I have to say.
Interesting. Both of the books we've just mentioned, Memoirs of an Ex-Prom Queen and the current one, A Good Enough Daughter, while one is fiction and one is a memoir, both seem to reveal you. Well, Memoirs seems to reveal you, the writer, and it seems that all of your writing does that. And I'm wondering if it's risky or does it make you feel vulnerable to be so honest in your work?
Well, it's always risky to be honest, especially in nonfiction. You can tell all kinds of true stories in fiction, but nobody knows whether they're true or not, and so it doesn't require the same degree of risk, except people get mad at you anyway, even though it's fictionalized. They still think that they're in your novel, or one person once asked me, why didn't you put me in your novel? You can't win, you know. They got you coming and going. But, yes, it is risky, but that is the joy of writing. I mean, you take a risk. It's scary. It's sort of like a roller coaster. It's both the pleasure and the fear that make it the memorable experience that it is. Yes, I did feel that I had to write this honestly. I wanted to explore my relations with my parents, and I reveal a lot of family secrets, and I explore in this book subjects that we never discussed in our family. So my way out was to realize that I couldn't publish this book until after my parents and my brother had died. It was pretty clear that they were going to die soon because, as I say, they were 89 and 95. One thing I always do when I write, I pretend nobody is ever going to read this book, and that enables me to write really freely and say what I need to say. Mm-hmm. And then I always promise myself, well, you can always take it out later. You can always take it out. But by the time I'm done, of course, I realize that I'm not writing in order to either conceal or reveal secrets, but to convey the knowledge that I have to the world. And I don't want to take it out by the time I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer really something I'm doing. Once I've finished a book, in a sense, it belongs not to me, but to the readers.
Now, when you started writing, was this characteristic of your style then, or did you have to work at becoming honest in your writing?
When I began writing Memoirs of an Ex-Prom Queen, I was passionate to express the feelings and knowledge that we had been uncovering in the early consciousness-raising groups of the women's liberation movement. And I felt that I was in a unique position to write this story, to give the world news of this new way of looking at women's experience that had been for a couple of years getting discovered in all these groups all over the country. I felt I was in a unique position because I was older than a lot of the other people in women's liberation by a few years. So I had already been married a couple of times. I had children. And I knew aspects of women's experience that many others didn't yet know. And so it never occurred to me to be concerned about what I was saying. I passionately needed to tell this story. It wasn't my story. It was a lot of people's stories. And I just wanted to be able to tell it as effectively as possible, which meant if there was something in my life that could serve my fictional purposes, I would use that. If not, I would use stories of other people, or I would use things that I'd make up out of my imagination. But it never occurred to me that I was going to be exposed, with one exception. I always worried about what my parents would think. That was the only time. But as I say, this purpose was much larger than any personal feeling of embarrassment.
So when you did worry about, say, what your parents would think, how did you prevent those worries from inhibiting you? or getting to you or stopping you from writing?
Well, I had already moved away from Cleveland Heights by the time I started writing. I'd been away quite a few years, and so I didn't have my parents looking over my shoulder in my mind symbolically anymore the way I would have had I stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
We had really disentangled ourselves from each other's lives pretty much by then. That was one thing. The other thing, as I say, I always pretend to myself that nobody will ever read this book, that it won't be published, or if it is, you know, I really thought that only the 10 people in my women's group were going to read it and get the jokes. And I was more astonished than anybody when it went on to be a national bestseller.
How do you keep that mentality of writing it freely as if no one will read it after you've had a number of books published?
Have you heard about the publishing world lately? I know lots of people who publish lots of books who are having a hard time getting published.
That's true.
I think that it's very easy for any writer to convince herself that the next book won't be published, because you forget how you did it. When you start a new book, it's always as if it's the first time. You think, how did I ever pull that off before? I'll never be able to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
I never have any confidence until the end. Also, it's a habit by now, you know.
Mm. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Alex Kate Shulman, author of A Good Enough Daughter. And I should also add that the opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the University of California Board of Regents. Alex, would you read to us?
I would be glad to. Let me just say that my new memoir is the story of my relations with my parents all the way through, from childhood on through their deaths. And there's a great change that occurs. I started out very loving, the daughter of loving parents. And then in my middle years, as I said before, I grew distant from my parents. And not until the end of their lives did we become very close again. So part of the story of this book is the way I did manage to break that bond and break away and become independent, and it was hard. I'm going to read a section from The Adolescent Rebellion, okay? My poor parents, I gave them a hard time. Cashmere sweaters being the key to social success in our high school, and given my father's unyielding attitude toward excess purchases, I felt myself gradually being sucked toward the swamp of crime. A girlfriend had told me about a new item in Hallie's sweater department, lamb's wool sweaters from England that looked exactly like cashmere's but were half the price. The next time I went downtown shopping, in the dressing room I hit on a plan. I would charge a lamb's wool sweater on my charge card, then take it and its cashmere look-alike into the dressing room, switch the two price tags, and, leaving the lamb's wool behind, proceed to the elevator with the cashmere in my package. I selected a pair of blue short-sleeved pullovers that looked exactly alike, certain that if I, an expert, couldn't tell one from the other with the naked eye, the scam was foolproof. Now it seems to me obvious that it couldn't have worked. The sales clerks who sold sweaters all day long were no less expert than I. Yet when I entered the elevator on the third floor, package in hand, with youthful arrogance, I thought I had pulled it off. Not until I proceeded through the exit door to be met outside by a waiting security guard did I realize my folly. "What I don't understand," said the manager, examining the charge card with my signature on the back, "is why you would want to steal a sweater when you were perfectly able to charge it. It doesn't make any sense to me." Even if I hadn't been too choked up to speak, how could I explain the arcane politics of money in our family? What stranger could understand that it was out of deep respect for my father that I stole, in order to spare him the disappointment of another painful encounter with the insatiably venal character I shared with Mom? At the thought of my father's disappointment, I dissolved in another round of sobs. The manager reached over her desk to offer me a tissue. When I had blown my nose, she picked up the phone and said, "Now I'm going to call your parents. What's your phone number?" my mother's or my father's? I asked. Which one would you like me to call? Which one? The manager was asking me to decide which heart to stab in order to be saved? Dumbfounded, I stared at her. Like certain children of divorce, pressed to take a side, I was absolutely unable to choose. Yet I had to choose. Any second, I would have to commit the most difficult act of my 15 years of life and select one of my unsuspecting parents to receive the crushing news of my having stolen and been caught. Knowledge, I suddenly realized, oh, why hadn't I seen it before, would break them. If my mother were called, she would defend and comfort me with boundless understanding. Until, confronted with the irrefutable evidence that I had done it, she would assume the blame herself, searching for all the ways she had let me down. And after blame, grief. How could I do this to my mother? My father, then, for whom theft was unthinkable, whom I shamed with my mere desires. Must my upstanding, law-revering, high-minded father, a lawyer whose partner was a former judge, be humiliated and dishonored by my recklessness? Having betrayed him by stealing, must I betray him again by disgracing him before the manager? No, not my father either, who would never understand. It was impossible. I could not choose. The manager waited, finger poised to dial. Well, she repeated, beginning to lose patience. This was the worst moment of my brief life. I had taken risks before, had cut school, forged my parents' signatures, cheated on tests, tampered with the schedules in the school office to arrange for myself and a girlfriend the equivalent in study halls of triple lunch, time enough to cross the forbidden ravine to Shaker Square to try on the new spring dresses at Franklin Simon and still be back in time for seventh period social studies. Filched tens and twenties from my father's wallet, schemed, shirked, lied, connived, and dragged my reluctant friends along with me. But not until today did I commit the inexcusable blunder of being caught. Not till this moment did I understand the price, a death blow to my parents' hearts. No matter which one heard first, both would be undone. Dad by shame, Mom by remorse. Finally, I chose Dad to take the blow. A lawyer and man of the world, he would know how to rescue me for the first of many times and could get here in under 5 minutes. My father, I said, and with a mix of terror and relief, I gave the manager his office number. Even in his 90s, with his powers greatly diminished, Dad remained the rescuer. Many months after Mom had made what her nurses called a reasonable adjustment to her new surroundings in the dementia ward, she suddenly began to balk. One night, in a rage, she demanded that her husband, who lived on the sixth floor in assisted living, be called at once. When Dad was on the phone, she said, "Take me home, Sam. They're keeping me prisoner here against my will. Please, I want to come home." It was more than Dad could bear. The next day, he commandeered a wheelchair and kidnapped his wife of 65 years. He helped her into the chair, piled nightgowns, slippers, and toothbrush on her lap. Then, huffing and puffing, wheeled her past the double doors to the elevator, up a ramp, and on through the halls to his apartment.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for asking me.
This is KUCI 88.9, and you've just heard Alex Cates Shulman read from A Good Enough Daughter. Your prose is so pristine. Does it come out that way, or does it evolve through rewriting?
Oh, my dear. Thank you for the compliment. It goes through so much rewriting, so much. And now that we have the word processor, which makes it so easy to rewrite as you're going along, you know, I can't even tell you how many drafts I go through. But always the goal is to make it seem effortless. And the more effortless it seems, believe me, the more effort has gone into it.
Do you read aloud? Do you read drafts aloud to pick up nuances, to pick up glitches?
I don't really, no. I read it silently. Then after I'm done, when I start doing public readings, I can notice things, and I realize that I have to change this and change that and at the last minute. But
It was moving to read in this book that your mother had wanted to be a writer and had written an essay, I believe, that won a contest.
It's so interesting. I didn't know my parents until I wrote this book, or rather, until I was preparing to write this book. I knew them only as my parents. I didn't really understand how they had lives of their own and lives that didn't even involve me very much. I thought I was the center of their life, of course. And I think that's very common for children, no matter how old we get. We think of our parents as our parents. Now, when I went back to Cleveland to move my parents to the retirement community and to get their house of 40 years ready to be sold, I went through that house, every closet and every drawer, and I found the most amazing evidence of their lives, that they were real people quite independently of me. I found my mother's writings. I found so much of her writings, all her manuscripts, and her every letter, all my parents' love letters, everything that my brother and I had ever written home, and all of our report cards, everything was saved. And it was then, really, that I rediscovered what I had forgotten since childhood, that my mother was indeed a writer. It's so ironic, because she had been writing and not been very successful in getting published, but she had been writing quite diligently throughout my childhood. She was an amazing woman. She did many more things besides writing, but I won't go into that now. Anyway, then she gave up after a certain point. At about the age of 40, she gave up. And much later in her life, after I started to publish, she began writing again. And I had the arrogant nerve to think that she was writing because I had become a writer, whereas in fact, when I went back and discovered how much she had written when I was a child, it turns out that the truth is that I became a writer in part because I had the model of my mother through my childhood.
That's interesting. As a child, you didn't observe her writing or did she tell?
Oh, I did.
Okay.
But I forgot. I forgot about it. It was just one of the things she did. It wasn't the way she was mothering me, so it didn't have much importance. And, you know, in those days, I grew up in the 40s. I graduated from high school in 1950. Back then, women were, especially after the war, they were supposed to be nothing but housewife mothers if they could, middle-class women. And my father, who was a lawyer and a labor arbitrator and who was expected to be the breadwinner, he was the one who got all the credit for the non-parenting part of his life from me and from everybody else. I find it so ironic, I who have spent my life devoting myself to doing away with sexism, was as sexist as everybody else in that society. Of course, you can't escape it. But I didn't even really appreciate who my father was on his own until I went back at the end of their lives. It turned out that he had 4,000 labor arbitration decisions that he was about to throw out when he retired at 90 and was going to close his office. By that time, I had the sense to make him promise not to throw them out until I had a chance to try to place them in an archive, and because they were a valuable record of labor history, you know. But he was a very modest man. He didn't think they were worth anything.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, give you a chance to have a sip of water, and all you out there listening, stay tuned. We'll be right back with Alex Kate Shulman, author of A Good Enough Daughter. Don't go away. You've been called, or I suppose you are, a feminist novelist and social advocate, and I wonder how your political beliefs affect your writing, or maybe I should say, how do they affect what you write about or don't write about?
I never make a choice to write about a subject that I think is important politically, but I am a political person. I am a feminist person, and so, of course, my interests and my concerns and what I think about reflect that. And that is always going to be important in choosing what I write about next. I didn't choose to write about my life with my parents or my parents' old age because I thought there was some political point to it. I just knew that it was something that, it was an experience that I had that was so intense and one that I thought would be shared by many, many people. And so I thought it would be interesting and perhaps even important. I learned so many things in caring for my parents in their final years and becoming close to them. You know, lots of old people do live out their lives at home. My parents could not because my mother had Alzheimer's disease. My father had congestive heart failure, and he was too weak to take care of her on his own, and she needed a lot of care as time went on. So they had to go into a retirement community, and eventually both of them were in the nursing home parts of this retirement community at the very end. But no matter how ill they got or how long they were there, one of the amazing things I discovered was that they remained themselves to the very end. A lot of people think that if you have Alzheimer's, you become a different person and that's the end of you. But I didn't find that at all. My mother had always been a gracious and charming hostess. And when she was in the dementia ward, I found she was still the charmer. There was one time when I went to visit her, I found her, a man in her room. He was in a wheelchair. She was kind of entertaining him. His words made absolutely no sense at all. I mean, they were English, but you couldn't make anything out of what he was saying. But my mother, even though both of them have Alzheimer's, I guess, my mother wouldn't let on that she couldn't make sense of what he said. She just kept nodding as though she understood every word. And though she couldn't remember how to get to the bathroom, which was only steps away from her chair, she still retained all her social graces. So I think that's a very important thing for people to know. Mm. I also think that, as I said earlier, people dread it, but taking care of their parents at the end. And I'm sure it depends entirely on, or anyway, a good deal on what kind of relationships you've had with your parents. But the truth is, our society treats the old very badly. And if there's something that my book might be able to do to help people see that change is needed, you know, that would please me very much. That wasn't the purpose in my writing it, but I do hope that it might have that effect now.
So I would imagine you, like many writers, have just so many ideas. And how do you then choose which ones or which one you're going to focus on for however long a time, a year, 2 years, perhaps
that's
some
short.
I mean, you know, like, what? How do you know what becomes an essay and is over with quickly but is given form, and then what becomes a book?
Oh, that's such a good question, especially since I'm wrestling with it at this very moment. Well, I have, by this time, accumulated quite a list of things I want to write. And some of them I started a while ago and then put aside. You know, I didn't get very far into them, but they're still active. They're alive in my imagination. How you choose, well, this book chose itself, and in a sense, they do choose themselves, or they seem to. They seem to batter on your brain until you let them in when they seem to have some urgency. I was with my parents and learning these astonishing things every single day at the end of their lives and taking notes because it was such an amazing experience for me. And I was living this experience. You know, I never before wrote about my family. I had always thought of it as kind of secret, or private, I should say, rather than secret. But when the time came to see them through the end of their lives and to witness my father's death. And so these were such extraordinary experiences that they demanded of me that I write them. And interleaving these last couple of years of their lives with my whole childhood and young adulthood and adulthood was so easy for me because those memories had been stored up in my mind for such a long time. They were just ready to be tapped. Now, I think it takes a great deal of material to write a book. And for this, I had so much because, in a sense, I had my whole life in relation to them. When it comes to an essay, I choose to write something as an essay because I don't think I have enough material to make it into a book. Sometimes I'm wrong, and sometimes what starts as a story, short story, or as an essay, turns out to demand book treatment. Memoirs of an Ex-Prom Queen, for instance, the opening scene I originally wrote as a short story, but I was never satisfied with the ending. And as I thought about the ending more and more, I saw that it would have to be a whole book to explain the situation.
Have you kept journals at any time in your life? I should let you answer that first.
Well, I only keep a writer's journal, mm-hmm. not any other kind, where I jot down, ideas and so on, or phrases, things I overhear. I don't keep a daily record or even a monthly record. During the time that I'm living all by myself in Maine on an island without a telephone or electricity or any much contact with anybody at all, and sometimes I stay for 4 or 5 months alone, then I tend to keep a journal because I'm talking to somebody, myself, mm-hmm. albeit.
Now, how do you then I suppose if it's a writer's journal, you do in some way use it in your writing, but how do you use a writer's journal? Do you go back to remember details that you really didn't want to lose, or is it a place to record ideas or work on something in progress?
I tend to have a notebook for each book I'm working on, and I do take notes, and then I divide things into sections and try to put the notes into the right sections. So I do use material that I've recorded. And it's a funny thing, when you're working on something and living in that world of it 24 hours a day, it seems that everything you see in the world, everything you hear, every headline, every overheard conversation bears directly on the work you're doing. It's a magical thing that happens. It has to do with focus. And so then I write those things down, and yes, when I'm lucky, I can use the notes that I've taken. But I'm not always lucky. It really depends a lot on which book I'm writing. A lot of the memoir I wrote before this one, which was about my life alone on that island in Maine called Drinking the Rain, did make much use of my journals and notebooks that I kept on that experience. But I think that for A Good Enough Daughter, much more than notes were the all of the documents and papers and photographs that I found in my parents' house. Those were the things that sparked my memory and brought events back to me.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Maine, now how does, it sounds just delightful to me to retreat so far away from sort of the teeming metropolis of daily life. But how does getting away from the city and really washing that away affect your writing?
Oh, I do my very best writing in Maine when I'm alone and I have nobody to answer to and no distractions. The rest of the time I live in New York City, and this is the most distracting city there is. I mean, every night has dozens of events that one wants to participate in, and I'm a political person, so I belong to various organizations that do work, but when I'm in Maine, there is absolutely no getting away from my writing. And now, even though I don't have electricity there or plumbing, now I have a couple of solar panels on the roof of my cabin, just enough to run my laptop. So now I can really work all the time. I say work, but it's my pleasure. It's my joy. The wonderful thing about being there is that my writing life and my living life are absolutely seamlessly connected. Here, it's harder because I have to, here in New York, I mean, I have to be very vigilant about not answering the phone and setting aside certain hours when I won't do anything else. But it's a struggle.
And how is it that you exercise that will to not answer the phone or not spend too much time emailing or on the internet? How do you do that?
Well, it's my life. That's what I do. I'm a writer, and I take it seriously, and so I just do it, and I've been doing it for 30 years. So it's pretty ingrained in me. I was going to say it's discipline, but I think a better word than discipline is devotion. I certainly don't sit around waiting for inspiration. I have to get at that. I have to sit there, even if nothing comes every day.
Voice is one of those things that make a writer unique and singular. How would you characterize your voice, and how did you find it? Was it one of those things that had come out soon after you began writing, or did you stumble onto it?
You know, it's something that I think my readers could answer about me better than I myself. I don't know my voice. I just write, and it seems that it comes out in my voice.
Is it maybe being true to yourself?
Pardon?
I wonder if it just gets back to the honesty aspect and just allowing yourself to be who you are and to allow that to come through in the writing.
I guess that is it. I have this faith that if you try to find out what you really think and what you really mean, then it will come out. It will come through. And that's where the struggle is. What do I really mean to say here? What am I trying to accomplish in this scene? And you're using the word honesty. It isn't one I use myself. It's because I just take that for granted. Mm-hmm. Why would I be dishonest? That would damage my work, you know. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's just, how can I get to what it is I'm really trying to say? But voice is, I guess, something else. Voice has to do with how the prose sounds uniquely mine. And I don't think I could make it any other way. I think that's something that the critic looking at the work will be able to discern. But the writer just writes as she must. It's true that sometimes when I'm writing certain scenes, I know that this is good and I am in the grip of some lyrical thing beyond me and I just go with it, you know. But those moments are rare. More of the time, it's a matter of rewriting, refining, trying to get closer to what I really was trying to get across, and cutting to get down to the essence of the idea or the feeling or the scene.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is author Alex Kate Shulman. How does compassion figure into your writing?
Oh, well, of course, that is at the center of it. It's the center. Unless you're just concerned with yourself, you're writing about people. And you try to get inside those people. And once you're inside them, you can't but, in a sense, love them. Even, I remember, you know, once I wrote a novel called On the Stroll, which was about a pimp and a young prostitute and a shopping bag lady, a homeless woman. Not people whom I knew in my ordinary life. And I became just so protective of these three characters. I felt that I was my characters. So that is another way of saying compassion. What is compassion but feeling with the other person, you know? I think that's a given of the kind of writing I do, which is a very personal kind of writing.
Hmm. What do you say to a newish writer who wants writing success before its time, before they're there, before their work has developed to a point where it's ready for prime time?
I do believe that success, especially with a capital S, is completely a matter of luck. It's the lottery. It's the timing. And it cannot be a goal. It can only be a byproduct. It's like happiness. You can't get it by going after it. You live as well as you can. You write as well as you can. You work as hard as you can. And if you're lucky, happiness, success are the byproducts of that. We've all heard about people who have struggled their whole lives and have died without having their books published, and then after they are dead, you know, they get great success. Well, that's what I mean about it's the lottery. No, I think that if you are devoted to it, if you feel very strongly that there's something you need to say that the rest of the world needs to hear, or some part of the world needs to hear, then and you develop the habits of discipline, if you're willing to be your own boss and all that that entails, I think it will come to you. I do believe that there are skills that come with time. I think there are two things that a writer needs, and one is the skill, the way of saying it, and the other is the vision, the thing that needs to be said. And unless you have those two things going for you together, your writing is going to, let's say, be missing something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no such thing as a perfect work. Well, maybe for poets, but not for prose writers. You can always go on to improve it. But at a certain point, you have to say, this is as good as I can do now. I'm going to let it go and see how it flies.
Mm-hmm.
That's another problem that a lot of would-be writers have. They don't know how to let it go. It's a matter of balance.
What about when writers try to write for the marketplace? They read, perhaps they read Publishers Weekly, they read about trends, and try to, you know, second guess perhaps what editors, what publishers will want.
I don't know anything about that because I've never done that. Mm. And I suspect that it can't really be done. But, you know, there's all kinds of writing in the world, and maybe it can be done. It's not something that I'm familiar with. Certainly, if you are going to spend the years that it takes to write a book, I think you would get very bored if it wasn't something you cared about passionately.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to short things, so to essays, reportage, even stories, that may not be the case, you know, because you could try and spend a month or so, and if it doesn't work out, well, you've only wasted a month. But when it comes to book-length texts that are going to convey you to the world, I think that marketing is secondary.
Mm-hmm. Characters in fiction, where do yours come from?
Characters in fiction. With my fiction, I'm almost always starting with theme and an idea, and I want to get something across. I want to dramatize a theme. And so I invent whatever characters and situations I think will get that across. Now, when I say invent, of course, many characteristics of my characters are characteristics of myself that I can look inside myself to find, or of people I know. But by the time they have been transformed by the imagination to suit the fictional purposes, you know, you might not recognize them at all. I mean, am I a pimp? Well, no. But there is that in me that can understand the pimp's life. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? I know I'm speaking abstractly here.
Some of
my characters, especially, well, certainly in my nonfiction, in my two memoirs, are drawn from life precisely. But, of course, any book is different from life. And so even though I tried to portray as truly as I could myself as a child, my mother, my father, my brother, they are not as they were in real life. They are only my perception of them. And I can prove this by saying that if any of them wrote about the others in this family of four, they would come up with an entirely different picture of each of the people. So they aren't true. They're only the best I can get at my idea of them.
Yes. This is KUCI 88.9, and my guest is author Alex K. Shulman. The photos in A Good Enough Daughter, were they your idea?
Oh, the photos. I had no idea that my publisher would be so wonderful as to say, oh, we want to put photos in. But the minute they did, I was delighted because I have all of these pictures. I am now the repository for all the family pictures. And I love them. I look at them and they just resonate so richly in my memory and in my imagination. So I was completely delighted. And some of them are, I consider, just gems. Yeah, it pleases me very much. I must say, this is the first book of mine to have photos, and I spent a lot of time trying to find the perfect one for each section, for each chapter, you know. And I considered picking the photos part of my writing process, actually.
Yeah, they're such a, just so necessary. The book would have been fine, certainly, without them, but they're just such, they just, I can't imagine it without them.
It's just, they're so charged for me. I don't know how they are for a reader. I'm glad to hear that you see them as integral. But for me, they are as charged as any memory.
How did the one get picked for the cover? You and your mother?
Oh, yes, me and Mom. The book designer just thought it was perfect.
Mm.
She said, in fact, she thought that I was going to object for some reason. Mm. And she loved it so much that she said, now look, I know we usually go through hundreds and hundreds of images to try and find something that's perfect, and it takes us a long time, and this one is so perfect. Would you please let us use it? Of course, I was delighted. I look up there and I say, hey, Mom, look, you're on the cover.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Thank
it's
you.
It's really lovely.
Thank you.
And the ending, too, of the book was quite a tearjerker, and it seemed that the book really did, well, of course, you know, there's a linear line, too, but the way you structured it and then the ending sort of being the height of the emotional involvement for the reader, how did you do this? How did you structure it or figure out how to build it to a certain point? Because it was in the words as well.
Inspiration? I don't know exactly how to answer it. I did know that it was going to be back and forth, that the present of the book was going to be the last few years of my parents' lives, and that it was going to incorporate a great deal of flashback because I wanted them to be rich, full people. And, of course, I had to show myself in both as a good daughter, as a bad daughter, and then finally in the end as a good enough daughter, which is the title. So it had to go back and forth, and I think I always knew that it was going to end with my parents' death, but it wasn't, I didn't want it to be a sad ending, because I do not think that death is a sad thing. Of course, grief is real, and you always grieve when you lose someone that you love, but it's the natural ending of our lives, and that was one of the things I learned. I didn't know that in advance. I learned that. And having learned that, I knew that I could not end on a note of pure sadness and death. And so I did tell that story at the end of how when I opened the rental car glove compartment to get out the the rental, what do you call it, the contract, I found a secret message from my father from beyond the grave in there. I won't tell what it was, but that I did, I still have that in my apartment, and sort of around their pictures. Maybe I should tell. I don't know. What do you think?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, when I was a child, my father always gave me and my brother and my cousins sticks of gum whenever he would come home or when he was pleased with us. That was his reward to us, Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. And when I opened that glove compartment after the funeral, as I was returning the car to the rental office, there was a stick of Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. Now, believe me, none of us put it in there. So I took it to mean that Dad was pleased with the way we had handled the end and his funeral, and then I went back to New York. And a year or so later, I was doing readings from a book, and I found I couldn't help but drive past my parents' house, and I found that it was, once again, all full of life, and so I thought that was a good place to end, because that's the message. I mean, it does go on. Life goes on. The generations pass, and it isn't necessarily a bad thing. Mm. It can be a very fulfilling thing.
Well, it is a bad thing that our time has come to an end, and it's just been a wonderful hour for me.
And for me too, Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I'll certainly be looking for your next book and your articles and essays and everything else that you do.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Alex Kate Shulman, author of A Good Enough Daughter. A wonderful book. A wonderful, wonderful book. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll be back next week with a literary author, Zoe Heller. This is KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. Writers on Writing is internet accessible, as are all shows here, at KUCI.org. And if you'd like to email me or get on the Writers on Writing mailing list, please go to my website via KUCI's website. And I'd like to leave you with a quote by Flannery O'Connor, wonderful writer as well. And she said, "You may write for the joy of it, but the act of writing is not complete in itself. It has its end in its audience." Thanks for listening.